Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. It's always fun to talk about birds, and especially with today's guest, Bill Volkert. He's a retired wildlife DNR educator, naturalist, worked at Horican Marsh for 27 years, been watching birds for well over 40, written a number of books, and has led many bird-watching tours. So always fun to have Bill with us, and certainly fun to have you join in. What would you like to know about maybe attracting birds to your yard? What questions do you have about fall migration? Join in. Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email or maybe a photo. Maybe there's a bird you want to have us identify or Bill identify. You can do that, too. Just go to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you what. I know you wanted to focus a bit on a couple of bird families today, kingfishers and waterfowl. Why those two?
Well, they're interesting groups as far as I'm concerned, because one of them, the waterfowl, are very well represented in Wisconsin and North America, and the kingfisher has a very wide, worldwide distribution with a lot of species, but we only have one. And for those people who are watching birds, they're relatively easy to see, and since both of them are tied to water, they'll remain in Wisconsin very late into the year. And where the streams are open or even out on Great Lakes, we'll find ducks and occasionally even kingfishers that remain right through the wintertime. So these are pretty observable birds. And for our waterfowl, which includes the ducks, geese, and swans, we have 37 species in Wisconsin. So very well represented. And we have both the diving ducks and the dabbling ducks, which are the mallards and teal, what people call the puddle ducks. And of the 37 species we have, 168 are found around the world. And for people who do a little traveling, if you find yourself in Europe, you're actually going to find a number of common ducks there. The mallard, pintail, shoveler, those are all found across not just U.S. and Canada, but across Europe and northern Asia. So they have a worldwide distribution in those northern latitudes.
That's pretty other interesting. Birds, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and then other birds such as the redhead duck and canvasback, those are North American birds, and they have a counterpart, though. The redhead duck has a very close lookalike called the pochard. Essentially, it's a cousin species that takes its place in northern Europe and Asia, and also the ringneck duck. Same thing. It has a lookalike called the tufted duck, named for a little tuft off the back of its head. And our mergansers, we have three species of mergansers, the fish-eating ducks, the common merganser, red-breasted, and very beautiful little one, the hooded merganser. Turns out that the red-breasted and common mergansers are also found all across northern Europe and Asia, but the hooded merganser is exclusive to North America, yet it has a cousin species called the smew, which is found in Asia and northern Europe. So interesting distribution. And also among some of the ducks, if you look around the world, there are some that are found in isolated areas, a few species just in southern Africa. Also southern part of South America has a few isolated species. So does Australia. So it's a wonderful group of birds that's found all around with a lot of variety. And it turns out that North America really has a great representation and some of the best duck nesting in the world out in the Prairie Pothole region, which the biologists and waterfowl hunters have long referred to as the duck factory. The kingfisher is a different case. We only have one.
Yeah, why is that?
Kingfisher. Well, it seems that that population or that species of bird arose more in the old world, in Europe, Asia. And we have just one that made it over here into at least North America, the United States, I should say, that being the belted kingfisher. When you get down right to the border with Mexico, far southern Texas, and then through Central and South America, you'll find a few others. The very large relative, the ring kingfisher, even bigger than our belted, a very tiny one called the green kingfisher. There's also the rufous and green, and a very small one, very appropriately named, that is the pygmy kingfisher. But there's 120 species of kingfishers around the world, and great variety found throughout Africa, India, and Asia. So that's really the heart of their distribution. And it's interesting when you look at these different families of birds, which ones are very well represented in our part of the world and others that maybe we don't find here at all. Or like the kingfisher, we just get one, and really the great diversity is found somewhere else.
Yeah.
Right now, our warblers are really moving. This is really the height of the migration. And what we call the American wood warblers are exclusive to the Western Hemisphere, birds that nest here in the United States and Canada and will spend their winter in Central and South America. And when I've met British bird watchers, that is a real goal for them, is to come to the United States and see our warblers. And they're moving right now.
They're moving right now. You know, I know you wanted to talk about feeding, and Judy in Racine has a question related to that. Let's go there. Judy, hi.
Hi. Hi, Bill and Larry.
Hello.
I just wondered if it's safe to put feeders out again. They suggested we take them in because of that disease that they were trying to figure out. Have they figured it out, and can we put the feeders back?
Excellent question. In fact, if you weren't going to bring it up, I was going to get to that because, yeah, that's been a hot topic. It started early summer. There was an outbreak of an unknown disease. It started around the Virginia area, Maryland, and started moving somewhat north in the East Coast and then to the west into Ohio and Indiana, Tennessee. And people were just noticing birds that were very lethargic, incapable of flying, and dying. And it affected primarily a few songbirds, especially grackles, blue jays, starlings, a few robins, and a couple of other birds. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the disease lab, was bringing in samples, doing analysis, and I have not been able to find any confirmed determination of it. So the warning was, especially in those states where they were finding bird deaths, say that eastern part of the United States, shut down feeders, let the birds disperse, and do not use your feeding station as a potential source for contamination. Social distancing among birds, so to speak. Well, it seems that the disease has just dispersed, that the number of dead birds has really gone down, and it seems to be something that sort of came and went. And the eastern states have now lifted that warning and told people to resume going back to bird feeding. Now, Wisconsin, we never told people not to feed. We said sort of stay on alert. If it gets here, we'll certainly respond to it. Some people did actually stop feeding because there's a lot of natural food in summer anyhow, just as a precaution. It seems that it never made it here, or at least no evidence that I have heard of, and it kind of came and went. So, yeah, time to start up your bird feeders again. I don't know if they're going to be able to, from the specimens they gathered, come up with a final determination of whatever caused this. But this also is a good heads up for people who feed birds any time of the year. Even knowing common diseases, especially salmonella, which is spread among bird droppings, keep those feeding stations clean, especially in wintertime. When you have snow accumulating, what I like to do is I keep snow under the feeder, and I either shovel more on top to bury the old bird residue, the seeds and so forth, as well as bird droppings, or occasionally just shovel it up and scatter it, throw it somewhere else, and then wash your feeders. So, yeah, keep it nice and clean out there. And certainly we want to benefit the birds. But, yeah, excellent question. Appreciate that.
Yeah, and one speculation I've had somebody tell me was the 17-year cicada.
The cicadas, yeah. I heard that one, too. I read up on that a little bit. But the cicada hatch, while it did really erupt out in those eastern states, in fact, in such huge numbers, they were picking it up on the Doppler radar. And in some cases, by the way, they even grounded planes. There were so many. It did not completely overlap where the bird deaths were. So the two did not completely overlap. Did it have something to do with it? We're not sure. And why would this hatch when we've never noticed it, you know, every 17-year cycle of something of the sort? So there was speculation, but nothing confirmed. But then again, every other avenue of investigation, there was nothing confirmed. It remains as a bird mystery, but at least people were watching and they were cautious. So we have to give them that much credit, and we're trying to help where we can.
Absolutely. Judy, thank you so much. William in Fond du Lac, your turn. Hi, William.
Yes, good morning. Fond du Lac Harbor has a confirmed common shell duck.
Yes, it's been there for some time. And the shell duck is actually a European bird, and it's actually a whole family of birds found in Europe, Asia, and with a few species in Africa. It's sort of almost like a subset of geese, kind of half goose, half duck. It's its own unique subfamily. And there's been some question whether or not this is a bird that has escaped from a game farm or whether it is a truly wild bird that made its way here. And perhaps it is a bird that has escaped because there are very few other North American records of shell ducks where other birds will cross the ocean. We've had even songbirds such as fieldfare, which is the European relative to our robin. They've made it over here. The crake, which common crake, which is the European counterpart to our sora rail, has crossed the Atlantic. And certainly some of the sandpipers, which are long-distance migrants, and occasionally waterfowl, such as we've had records of tufted duck, European widgeons numerous times. These birds will wander a long way. But it's a little bit unsure whether this shell duck made it on its own or not. However, that's just for people who want to keep a list of truly wild birds that they sight. It is a spectacular-looking bird. It's a worthwhile sight. It's very colorful. And, yeah, he's been hanging around that area right by Fond du Lac shoreline there by the Lakeside Park for quite some time.
Yeah. William, thanks so much.
I appreciate that.
I
didn't realize, actually, that it was still there. Yeah, great sighting.
Anne Marie in South Milwaukee, we turn to you now. Hi, Anne Marie.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate you highlighting the kingfisher and the ducks. These are species I love. But I am calling in with a question about the long-eared owl. It was like mid to late August. My friend and I were walking, and it was dark. It was evening. And we were under a tree, and we heard this screeching, and she's like, oh my god, that's got to be a screech owl. I'm like, well, that doesn't sound like a screech owl to me. And so I thought, well, maybe it's a young one. And then that night I was awake, because I always have the windows open, I was awakened to like what I would call a hoot owl, which I know there isn't any such thing. So I'm like, okay, I got to go searching and figure out what these calls are that I'm hearing. And the long-eared owl, I think, was the one who made both of those calls. Could you speak to that and like the prevalence of this owl? Because I've never heard it before.
Oh, that's a great question and a wonderful bird. Long-eared owls are known for a real variation in their screeches, hoots, and calls. It's a bird that doesn't have, say, like the great horned owl and the barred owl, very simple, recognizable vocalizations. They seem to have a real variety in the types of hoots and even wails that they'll make. It's a real mystery bird. It's a wonderful find, I'll tell you that. Most bird watchers that I know find them on their roost in real heavy spruce trees during the day. They tend to be quite reclusive, and sometimes they'll come back to the same site for several days in a row. Obviously, if they're dependent on that, you want to watch from a distance and not disturb a bird like this. But it's a bird we really don't know a lot about their status. Obviously, owls are difficult to survey, because we don't see them very often, since they just roost very exclusively during the day and then out at hunting after dark. We will hear them. The problem is they only call occasionally, so it's not a good indicator of any numbers. We certainly can detect a presence. Oh, here an owl, here one there. We know they're around, but how many, how successfully are they nesting? They're a tough one to survey, and especially the long-eared owl with its very secretive nature. Hard to get a good handle on the status of that bird. It's a bird that bird watchers will find occasionally and is always a worthwhile sighting, but it's not a good indicator of the presence or numbers of the birds. So, yeah, anybody who finds long-eared owl, always a wonderful sighting. It's a spectacular bird.
Anne Marie, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Well, Bill Volkert, our guest today, as we talk about birds and bird migration with him. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, Or you can email us. The email address is ideas at WPR.org. Ideas at WPR.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today. Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at birds today on the program with Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Always fun to have Bill come by. Questions about maybe a bird you've sighted in your area, or maybe a question about feeding, bird habits. I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Mike emailed. He lives in the village of Waukesha. And last year, in the fall, he watched hundreds and hundreds of nighthawks flying by and wonders, was it migration? Do you know if or when this could be happening again?
Well, nighthawks actually have a pretty narrow window of migration and are fairly early migrants. It's usually in the last week and a half or so of August and sometimes into the first week. Maybe a week and a half in September. And usually calm nights, they don't fly with a real strong wind, so a little bit of a light breeze or calm evenings with no wind. And just before sunset, we'll see them flying overhead. Their numbers have been going down. I missed them this year. I just wasn't in the right spot. There's still a chance of maybe one or two late migrants moving through, but I think the real peak has just passed. They're related to the whippoorwill, but they will fly then, as I say, right around dusk. And there were a number of good reports of some flocks. Sometimes it might be just a dozen birds, or sometimes you hit it just right, there'd be just this concentration of several hundred birds that'd be passing overhead. And they'll actually be feeding while they're flying. You'll see them sort of darting back and forth, catching insects along the way just around dusk time as they move overhead quite quietly. Springtime, they tend to call a little bit more. They're usually a late arrival. About the third, fourth week of May is when we start to see the nighthawks coming back again. And they spend the winter down in Mexico and Central America.
We had a listener email that late summer, August, September, in southern Lincoln County, he had several sightings, this is last summer, of what appeared to be a small game bird. It had a fairly large patch of white on its back. Would this be a young turkey? There are a number of turkeys in that area.
Well, there are turkeys all over the state. And in fact, we've got turkeys all the way up to the south shore of Lake Superior, which is way beyond their traditional or historic range. So it's a bird that, through the reintroductions, has not only reestablished itself, but probably is more widespread and more abundant than at any other time. And, yeah, turkeys will try to have a single brood in a year, so only one chance at a family. But as a ground nester, the nests are sometimes raided by raccoons or other mammal predators. And so there may be a re-nesting. And so sometimes we may actually see an adult with relatively small young ones yet in August and early September. That would be a re-nesting attempt. They look a little scruffy, of course. So, in other words, the field marks that we normally identify adult turkeys by are not always, they're still developing, they're not always that visible in the young birds. But, yeah, there's probably a pretty good chance that's what he was seeing.
Donald.
White on the back is not a typical field mark for any of those game birds.
No, it isn't. Donald in Fort Atkinson, your turn. Hi, Donald.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I have about 30 bluebird nests, and this year had no bluebirds in them. And we've noticed at our cabin that we have almost no hummingbirds. I understand the bluebirds were probably decimated in the cold snap in Texas. Did that affect the hummingbirds also?
Well, you're right on the bluebirds. Yeah, there were reports from the bird watchers down in Texas that those extreme cold temperatures and ice storms in particular is what affected bluebirds. Cold weather, they can get by. In fact, we've had bluebirds that overwinter in Wisconsin. Some of the Christmas bird counts will occasionally pick up bluebirds here because they're shifting their diet over to berries. And as long as there's food out there, they can make it. But it was the ice that basically sealed in all that food And, of course, the energy demands go up as temperature goes down. So they needed more food to get through that cold snap, and it was basically out of reach of those birds. So, yeah, bluebird numbers were severely impacted by that ice storm, cold winter weather for Texas. And that was noted by people all over Wisconsin that a lot less came back again. The hope is that those that did come back raise their families, rebuild the numbers, and hopefully we don't see another catastrophic event like that for some long time. They'll build back up again. Now, hummingbirds will travel all the way down into the tropics. So they're spending their winter much farther south where that kind of weather would not affect them. I thought hummingbird numbers were fairly good this year again. I have not seen much as far as overall decline among reports. But like a lot of these birds, you know, if you have one pair in your backyard and you're visiting your feeder, it's a daily occurrence. If they're not there, they may be somewhere else in the neighborhood. You're just not seeing them. So that kind of a small perspective of just watching your feeder, your backyard, is not always a good reflection of the regional population. And as I always remind people, I used to hear this when I was doing the chronic wasting disease monitoring on the opening weekend. What a deer hunter sees just from his stand is not a good indication of the statewide or countywide deer population either. So, yeah, when we get reports of a lot of people, that cumulative data gives us a much better handle of the status of birds like anything else.
Donald, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Debbie in Conover, we'll go to you now. Hi, Debbie.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
My question was, about a week ago, standing out on my pier, I noticed the bald eagle, but it was with a pack of six. And they were, like, swarming, like doing a sky dance. It was beautiful to watch. And for, I would say, 20 minutes. And there was another bird. I think it was one of the gray sand cranes. I'm not sure. I probably don't have the name right. But it's that large gray bird that swoops down
sand
and
hills.
Stands in the water.
Yeah.
Thank you. It was a young one. And the it seemed like the larger eagle took off after him and tried to steer him to the other ones up in the sky. It was just a weird, like, I had never seen that ever. I wondered if they,
well, that's
is that how, do they hunt in packs? I thought that is the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
Well, you know, they're usually solitary hunters because if you're looking for fish, you know, everybody wants their own good fishing spot. The only time you're going to see eagles gathered together is certainly when they're raising their young, or in wintertime where you've got abundant fish, say along the Wisconsin-Mississippi rivers below the dams where it's some of the only open water during severe winter and there's a high concentration of available food, they tend to crowd together there. But that's just simply taking advantage of a local food source, not, say, cooperatively hunting. That is a really interesting observation. Perhaps they were trying a little bit with some of their young, trying to increase their advantages and teach them how to hunt. Now, eagles are certainly known for primarily taking fish, but they also will scavenge, especially in the wintertime. And like a lot of predators, they'll take advantage of whatever is available. They've been known to go after loons, especially loon chicks. You know, there probably is a long list of things that have been found on the menu, though certainly fish makes up the vast majority of their diet. But yeah, interesting observation that you'd have them not just swarming together like that, but almost seemingly to cooperatively hunt.
Very interesting. Thanks, Debbie.
Yeah, fascinating.
Mike in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I live in Milwaukee. On September 1st, I was at Summerfest, by the Summerfest Lagoon. I'm fairly positive that I saw several anhingas there. Am I seeing things, or this is the day after Irma made landfall in Louisiana. Is that possible?
Okay. Well, there's few things that are impossible in the bird world, quite honestly. And we have noticed that when some of these big storms come up from the south, that those winds, these storms may be hundreds of miles across. So I'm not talking about birds getting swept up in the eye and flung for hundreds of miles, but in those wide circulating winds picking up and maybe getting out of the way ahead of those storms, they'll ride on that. And we've had birds show up from southern states that just plain don't belong here. There was an interesting report of a magnificent frigate bird seen down around the Milwaukee from there toward Chicago area. I've not heard any confirmation or any additional sightings of that. That's a bird that doesn't belong here, that you find along the Gulf Coast, that's the coastal areas of Central America, Northern South America. So I wouldn't say impossible. We have had sightings of anhingas that have been confirmed in Wisconsin. So
what are they like?
A bird that occasionally comes up here, but cormorant is also the other more likely one.
Yeah. What is an anhinga? I'm trying to remember what they look like.
Yeah, great question. We have just one species in North America, mostly in the southern states, from Florida along those southern Gulf Coast into Texas and then in throughout Central and Northern South America. The folk name for it is snake bird. And so it looks a little bit and acts a bit like a cormorant. They will actually compress their feathers and sink down where you'll see just the head and neck sticking out with this long pointed dagger-like beak. And that's the real distinguishing feature between that and the cormorant. The cormorant's got a more stout, heavy bill with a little hook. The anhinga has this long pointed beak. It is a jet black bird with a white streaking in the wings. And you'll see them, like cormorants, hold their wings out and drying because they haven't got a good oil gland, so they can get a little waterlogged from diving. It's got a much larger tail than the cormorant. The two, from a distance, look somewhat alike. And as I said, we've had a few records of anhinga in Wisconsin, but as you reported, maybe a half dozen. I would think more likely cormorants, which we've got certainly plenty of, and they will gather up in groups, especially this time of the year. I've been seeing some nice flocks moving along the Lake Michigan shore in the last few weeks. So possible,
but again, Mike.
You know, nothing is impossible, or very few things are among the bird world.
Thank you, Mike. Bruce in Middleton, your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about red-winged blackbirds. I notice in beginning about early August that I start to see, of course, lots of juvenile birds. And then as August progressed, in the usual spots where I bird, they're pretty much gone. I'm not seeing them in big marshes or big grassland areas that I usually go. So, and I know they'll be back. They'll be back sometime in the fall. It'll be passing through in big numbers. But my question is, where are they right now?
Well, actually, red-winged blackbirds can stick around pretty late in the year. I used to get some very large flocks, not every year, but quite often on the Christmas bird count. So that would be late December or, you know, right around the early first week of January. And some of these birds will stick around quite late, as long as there's not real heavy snow cover that they can feed on the ground for waste grain in particular. What they'll do is move to these big roost sites in the large marshes. So working, of course, at Horicon Marsh, that was always an attractive roost site. So what really happens with these birds is when they arrive in spring, you'll see the big flocks come through. They'll stop in the trees, feed in the farm fields, and then slowly disperse to the wetlands and even some of the upland grass fields where they'll be nesting as families. Some of them may be isolated as a family here and there in the marginal habitat, or in really good wetlands, you'll actually see the males staked out across a pretty big area. So they'll be nesting there, moving to the uplands to find food. And then as the young actually mature, as we get into late summer, they'll start to move around into upland fields looking for more food. As you're seeing them finding those upland fields where food is available, especially the invertebrates and seeds. And then they'll start to gather into bigger flocks. Just the other day, I saw a flock of, it had to be well over 1,000 birds fly by my area here in the northern Kettle Moraine. So the flocks are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Oftentimes, as we get into October, November, even into early December, I've seen flocks that will stream across, coming back in the evening to places like Horicon Marsh, El Dorado Marsh, some of these big wetland evening roosts. They may stretch out for well over a mile and number in the tens of thousands of birds. So, what you're seeing is right now a local movement of these birds and gathering the flocks. So, in other words, it's really punctuated where they are. If you're at the right place, you can have all the birds gathered right there. In other places, they've pretty well vacated now.
Bruce, thank you so much. You know, just related, you mentioned Horicon Marsh, and Ed emailed to ask when is the best time to go to Horicon to see height of migration, which he assumes is mainly ducks and geese, but what other large migrations or other types of birds are coming through there at the same time? And are there other good birding sites near or south of Horicon?
Mm-hmm. Excellent question. Well, quite honestly, for any really, really good habitat area, the best time to watch birds is almost any time of the year, but it changes. And so right now, places like Horicon, where you have a big open wetland surrounded by large sweeps of agricultural land, these little woodlots are actually real attractive little islands for the songbirds. So a lot of the songbirds right now, warblers, vireos, thrushes, are gathering there on their way south. And so we're starting around early now. And the duck numbers, they'll start building up a little bit more as we get into September, October, and even early November. And so, yeah, you know, there's different times of the year to go for different groups of birds. Also, I've been understanding that along the south shore of Lake Superior, warblers have been gathering there. They're coming down out of Canada following their nesting season. And as I said earlier, the songbird migration is really peaking right now. So any good woodlot area is a place where these birds might be found. The problem in fall birding for songbirds is that you really have to be looking for them quite intentionally. It's not quite so easy as in spring. Springtime, songbirds are arriving just as leaves are emerging. They're in their bright spring colors, and they're singing actively. So we can detect them by their vocalization as well as see them through the more open vegetation. Right now, our leaves are still really abundant and thick, so these little songbirds are well hidden overhead. And you have some of the adults that are starting to molt into their winter colors. They're losing the bright summer plumage. And there's a lot of juveniles now. All the young of the year are coming with them. They don't have the bright colors. And so bird watchers are out there looking for these birds, but you have to be looking for them and actually peering into the treetops and have a good field guide with you so you can sort them out, especially in these more less characteristic spring colors. They're a little bit more dull colored now, and some can be quite confusing. I've been seeing reports for the last week now, bird watchers and a number of sites all across Wisconsin are finding 12, 15, 20 species of warblers in a single day. So they're there, but you got to really be looking for them. You got to do a little study for it. But it is a fascinating look at the natural world. And they're only going to be around here for about the rest of this month as they make their way down to the tropics for the wintertime. Then they're gone until next May.
Pair of binoculars really helps.
it's absolutely essential, yeah. Especially to, first of all, peer into the treetops to even see these little 4.5-inch birds, much less to sort them out among the different species. And the other trick is not only is there a lot of foliage out there for them to hide behind, but as they're actively feeding, they don't sit still, so they don't always give you a really good view. They don't just perch out in an open branch and sit there until you get an opportunity to study them. You got to poke around and look for them, get a quick glimpse, get a study. But people will build up their skills like anything. The more you look at them, the more you study them, you'll get to sort them out. It may take a little while, but then you get faster at it, and you start to realize there's much greater variety there than certainly was evident at first glance.
Let's take another call. Ann in Madison, thank you for calling.
Hi, just a comment. We saw a small flock of perhaps a dozen birds of nighthawks on Monday evening when we were coming back into town.
So one more wave of nighthawks coming through. And yeah, people were reporting nighthawks for the last, about 2.5 weeks or so. It seems to be just the right weather conditions just before sunset so that all of a sudden you get a nice glimpse of them passing overhead. Always a nice, very short-lived phenomenon there for the year. So good for you.
Thanks, Ann. Cheryl in Conover, your turn. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
In May and June, my yard was filled with grosbeaks, bluebirds, all of the woodpeckers, pileated, downy, and hairy woodpecker. They were feasting on my yard, which has suet and seed and everything. And one day in June, they didn't come back. I had four sets of grosbeaks, one set of bluebirds, and at least three sets of the woodpeckers along with the finches, and it was like a shade was pulled. They came, they fed, and the next day not one bird came, and I said to my husband, I wonder if we have a predator hanging around here.
Yeah, that's a good guess, I think, Bill.
Yeah, that's always a possibility, especially the Cooper's hawk, which will hunt other birds. Yeah, that's a bird that can certainly spook the birds off of bird feeders. And we've talked about this in the past. If you've got a Cooper's hawk that's taking advantage of your bird feeders, you're kind of luring the birds in, not just to feed them, but to set them up for a predator like that, making it easier. So if that is the case, if you're actually seeing a hawk around the feeders, just shut down your feeders for about 10 days, 2 weeks. The birds will disperse, and with that, as the hunting goes down, the hawk will eventually move on too. The other thing is that I've noticed for my feeders, I've been filling them all summer long, and the last month or so, I hardly am filling them at anywhere near the rate that I was earlier in the year. And that's just because there's so much natural food. They're not that attracted to it or that dependent. There's plenty of other food out there. And, of course, that'll change as we get into wintertime. You know, even in wintertime, most of the birds get the majority of their food from the wild, even then. But that's, of course, with the occasional storm and cold snap, this can be something that can carry them through. Right now, it's more just that convenient stop. They stop at the feeder because it's there, but they don't really need it. And as we talked earlier in the program with the mystery disease outbreak earlier this year, people shut down their feeders not just to avoid subjecting birds to possible contamination, but they also didn't need that food. So with that, yeah, you know, could be either a predator came in as well as the fact that they just didn't even need that food so desperately.
Cheryl, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife DNR educator, talking birds with him. You can join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of birds today with our guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. You can call us. The number's 800-642-1234. And let's take another call. Hakeem in Sauk County. We'll give you a chance now. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, thank you. Yeah, so recently, just yesterday, on the Pine River Trail, you know, the one that is in Richland County. It goes to Richland Center from Lone Rock. I heard a few vireo species, the warbler-like birds. One was a yellow-throated vireo, and the other was a warbling vireo.
Oh, well, a nice sighting there, Bill.
Yeah, definitely. And while I referred to this as really being that peak of the warbler migration, I think we refer to that just because there's such a great variety among those birds. Yeah, the vireos are moving with them. The thrushes are also. So this is really that songbird migration. Interesting that Hakeem had actually heard them singing. They don't call that much in fall. Doesn't mean they won't at all. But, yeah, most birders are really using their eyes more than their ears at this time of the year. And, yeah, they are definitely on the move. But, as I say, you've got to be watching for them. There's a lot of hidden, and I always refer to this fall migration, especially for songbirds, as the silent procession. They're quietly moving overhead in huge numbers. And you have to think about it that in springtime, where birds are so easy to see, we actually have more in fall because they're coming back with all their young, too. So this is the peak of the population. But it's something that is happening quietly overhead. But get out there and take a close look. There's lots to see and lots to find.
Glenn emailed. He wondered if the robins have left the state yet.
No. Just like the bluebirds, we'll pick up robins occasionally on the Christmas bird counts. I think the big departure for robins tends to be in October, some lingering into November even. But, yeah, especially here as we get into October, There's lots of food because they are also shifting over to berries in large part. And this seems to be a pretty good year. My dogwood shrubs are just loaded with berries, and I've been noticing them slowly disappearing. And over the next, say, 2 to 3 weeks, we'll see them being picked pretty clean as robins and other thrushes and catbirds really start hitting the berry crop out there. And it's a nice timing for nature. You know, it's wonderful how this whole natural machinery works together so well. The bushes need to get those seeds dispersed, so they rely on the birds. They advertise as a bright berry and make themselves available. The birds gobble that up. And it also occurs right now when they need the energy. So the birds are loading up on it, and they do the favor of the for the bushes that as they pass those seeds through their system. They're dispersing them all over the countryside. Unfortunately, they're doing the same for the buckthorn and honeysuckle, the non-natives that we don't need, our invasives. But, yeah, for the native bushes, same thing. They're really loading up on them now. And they oftentimes will thin out in numbers as that food crop starts to decline. So as we get into the mid-late October, a lot of the robins move out, but also we'll see some remaining. I remember this past winter, my wife and I took a little drive. We're down along the Wisconsin River. And where the river was mostly frozen, especially along the shore, a little bit of open water, and then some backwaters were open with some springs. And here we found 50, 60 robins all gathered around that, and they spent the winter right there. There was food available for them, and they decided, well, instead of taking all that energy and effort to migrate, hang out there and hope the food doesn't give out.
Interesting. Glenn, thanks for that email. Ed in Heartland, your turn. Hi, Ed.
Yes, good afternoon or good morning, gentlemen. I have observed a behavior. This would be spring on nesting season, and it's a white nuthatch. We have a quite an old hickory tree outside of our kitchen window, so it's easy to observe this behavior. This nuthatch will have something in its beak, and it will brush around the hole in the tree vigorously, and this will go on for at least a week or possibly as many as 2 weeks. And, of course, they're in competition with gray squirrels. I've also seen the bird do a dance and puff up when the squirrel would come within the hole of the tree. So I'm just wondering what's going on with that nuthatch.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great little dance when they do that. They'll drop their wings, they'll fluff up their feathers, they'll try to look a little bigger in size and then jump around a little bit, trying to spook something else out of the area. I'll see them actually do that around the bird feeder occasionally when they're trying to chase other birds out and trying to claim the first in line at the bird feeder. Nuthatches, well, most of their food is really probing for invertebrates among the bark of trees, but they will take seeds, as you notice them coming to the feeder. Now, chickadees do the same thing. They'll grab a big sunflower seed, fly off somewhere, and you'll see them hold that between their feet and hammer on it with their little beak, trying to open that hull to extract the seed. Well, nuthatches aren't able to do that. They need those big claws on their feet to hang onto the tree. So what they'll do is they'll wedge that seed into the bark and then peck on it and extract it. Or they'll occasionally, if they find food to be abundant, they may cache it. Actually grab a seed, fly over, wedge it up into the bark, put it there for another time. I've watched them do that at my feeders. They're caching away the seeds and just don't realize, well, I'm going to fill that feeder no matter what. There's going to be plenty of food there. But nature taught them if there's available food, take advantage of it. If you can't eat it all, store it away for the hard times. And that's probably what he's doing with it, is caching some of that food. Or if you see them wedge it into the bark and actually tap on that, they're trying to extract the seed, the meat out of it. As I say, they're not able to hold it with their feet, so they'll wedge it in there and then beat on it and pull the food out.
There you go, Ed. Thanks. That's really interesting. Jeff in Berry Mills, I believe?
That's right, just east of La Crosse.
Okay. What's on your mind?
I wondered about the orioles. I noticed they quit coming to the feeder. I had about three families of them, and I noticed they left about the third week in July, right around the 21st. And do they go into the woods and eat berries and bugs too, or did they take off and start migrating right away?
Yeah, July is a little early for that bird to be migrating. I've noticed the same thing here. They were coming regularly to my feeders and hitting even the hummingbird feeders. And all of a sudden, they just seemed to stop. And I wonder what happened, if there was nest failure or not. And then later on, I saw a young one show up and a female. So I knew they're around. I think it's just a matter of so much natural food being available that they just don't bother with it. And they're finding a much more varied diet out in nature. Orioles is one of those birds that their exact departure is really hard to determine. And this is true for a lot of our summer birds. You know, springtime, you certainly know when the first oriole shows up. You look out the window and there's that brilliant black and orange bird sitting out, and we haven't seen them for months on end. It's always a welcome sight. But the day they leave, this is that kind of a silent departure. So they don't show up to the feeders very often. They're finding other food. They're hitting up among the treetops, in the leaves. They're no longer singing or calling actively, so we don't detect them by their voice. And then all of a sudden, one day they're gone. And it's the opposite, where springtime, you know as soon as they show up because there it is. But in retrospect, when is the last time you saw that bird, and when did he actually leave? So you notice after several weeks, boy, I just haven't seen anything, even if you only see him maybe once every week or so. And it's just the assumption he must have left somewhere in that time period. So it's a little harder to determine the departure of the bird. Just because we're not seeing them doesn't mean they necessarily left. And when we know we haven't seen them for a long time, we know they must have certainly pulled out. But when that is, you know, that's all guesswork of when they actually departed. But yeah, this is the time of year. They're certainly starting to head out. But as I say, hard to put a real date or a window on it when they're dispersing.
Thanks,
and
Jeff.
And another bird heading to Central America.
Yeah, right. Jeff, thank you. Bill in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, I'm curious about the increased quantity of pelicans around Janesville or southern Wisconsin for the last 3 years. They were occasional visitors during the migration, but in 2019, there must have been a couple of hundred of them hanging around from, say, April to July. This year, there must have been 100 of them for the same period. The last one I saw was in late August, and it just... Prior to this, there would be an occasional pelican during migration. So I was wondering if how things are changing, or if it's general, or, you know, what you can tell me.
Yeah, excellent question. Yeah, for the last 20-plus years, pelican numbers have really been increasing in Wisconsin. In fact, myself, a good friend of mine, Sumner Madison, who's with the Endangered Species Program, the Natural Heritage Program for DNR, we worked on a paper on white pelicans in Wisconsin. We looked at the historic sightings all back in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. They were seen about, on average, every 3 to 5 years, a bird more or less get off course. 1 to maybe 5 birds, usually non-breeding birds, were seen in Wisconsin. And then all of a sudden, they started hanging around as we got into the late 90s. With the mid-90s being the first nesting noted up by Green Bay, then at Horicon, eventually a population established Lake Winnebago. They were hanging out along the Mississippi River, eventually nested there. And I used to get reports from people assuming that birds were nesting, say, on Lake Sinisippi, south of Horicon Marsh, out on Beaver Dam Lake. The young non-breeding birds will gather in big flocks during the summertime and not necessarily be any evidence of nesting. And interesting, they're colonial nesters. So it's not a single nest, but a whole group of them. And they lay their eggs on the ground, usually isolated islands where they can be away from predators. And some of these sites, you may actually then have perhaps a good hatch of fish or something that brings them in, and those birds will come back, whether those are the non-breeders just floating around looking for food, or the adults and their young that's starting to move around, especially in late summertime. But yeah, populations have really increased. The number of nest sites and nesting birds has really gone up and has become a well-established bird throughout so much of the east central part of Wisconsin, where we've got a lot of the wetlands and along the Mississippi River.
So lots of them there. And Dave, by the way, Dave called to say you should talk more about seabirds because one good tern deserves another.
Yes, it does.
Of course,
we can talk a little bit about geegers here after our break.
Oh, tern, of course, T-E-R-N. That's the tern we were that Dave was talking about. Oh man, always great to get a little comment like that on the show. Bill Volkert, our guest today, and he's going to be with us right up until 12:30. We'll be talking with him about birds, and we're certainly inviting you to join in with your questions. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Wanted to mention that the 17th annual Great Wisconsin Quilt Show is coming up. It's put on by our friends from PBS Wisconsin and Nancy Zeman Productions. And this year it's being held online. It's Thursday, September 9th through Saturday, September 11th. And it's going to feature interactive educational opportunities from nationally known experts. There's some fun quilt challenges. There's a photo gallery, quilt exhibits, a virtual vendor mall, and a community service project, or actually several community service projects as well. And the good thing is admission's free, and you can register right now. Just go to quiltshow.com. quiltshow.com. Wanted to get that in there. But just a reminder, Bill Volkert, he'll be with us right till 12:30. You stay with us. We'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking bird watching and birds with Bill Volkert today, a retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years. So as we talk with him, our lines are all filled right now. So the number is 800-642-1234. There's emails to ideas@wpr.org. Some nice photos sent in, so we've got lots to talk about with Bill, and I think we'll get right to it. Bill, I don't know, can you see our photos that came in from Luann?
Yes.
Luann and Hale's Corners sent these photos looking for an ID of the birds at her feeders. They have black streaks on their wings and stomach. She thinks they might be juvenile brown-headed cowbirds, but what do you think?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. In fact, one bird in particular, I can see the shape of the bill. So the cowbird has a little bit more of a shorter conical shape bill than other blackbirds. That's pretty visible on particularly one bird, the way his head turned. And they're very grayish looking overall, look somewhat like the female looks. But then you've got this glossy black coming in on the wings and on the body. And those are the molting feathers, so the adult feathers are starting to come out of these. These are young males, and so they're looking a little scruffy. They're not really easy to identify, certainly not by plumage, but by that overall shape, and especially by the bill and the size of the bird. Yeah, these are the young cowbirds and visiting her feeder. So really interesting, because they're only going to have that kind of plumage for a short time during the summertime here, once they're leaving the nest. And yeah, real fascinating look at them.
And Johnny emailed a photo of two pileated woodpeckers dancing around a tree, and this is near Pound, Wisconsin, for over 20 minutes. They always stayed on opposite sides of the tree as they danced around it. This was June 25th, so it seems a little late to be competing for mates. Any ideas what they were doing?
I have seen them do that in spring as well, and I've usually assumed that to be part of a courtship behavior. Yeah, June is a little late, especially for what's a year-round resident and a bigger bird that usually starts to nest a little sooner in the season to raise its young to maturity. But yeah, I've always assumed that sort of a dance on each side of the tree and poking their heads back and forth, almost kind of a peekaboo thing, and going up and down the trees. I've always thought that that was a courtship behavior. Perhaps that's what it was a little later in the season, of a pair just interacting. Sometimes you'll see some of this behavior going on even after nesting has been initiated, which just helps to strengthen that pair bond of birds. So in other words, that commitment to a family. So I would assume that's just part of a courtship or pairing of birds, even that late in the season.
Stuart in Token Creek has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, good morning, or afternoon, I should say. So I have a bird, I believe it's a bird, every night after dark, it starts making a noise out in the top upper canopy of one of my maple trees. And I've gone online, tried to pick out what kind of bird sound it would be. And I thought, well, maybe it's a tree frog, but I don't think a tree frog is going to be that high in the canopy in the same tree every night. But I have a little recording. We'll see if you can pick it out among the crickets and the frogs.
Sure, we'll give it a try. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Yeah, what do you think?
Hmm, curious.
Yeah.
Not registering anything. Maybe one of the other listeners might have a bit of a suggestion or hint here. Yeah, there's very few birds that are actively calling in the evening. So
I'm thinking it's not a bird.
I'm not picking anything out as any particular bird species. But right now really is a peak of crickets and the kiwis calling. So yeah, they're really noisy this time of year. Then he's really got quite the sort of a chorus of them singing out there in the background.
Hang on to that recording, Stuart.
Yeah.
Next time we have one of our entomologists on, they may have an idea about what it is. It's worth a try anyway. Thank you for calling. Susie in Pewaukee, your turn. Hi, Susie.
Hi. I was wondering if you could help me with a sighting I saw in spring, and it was after numerous windy times, and on my clothesline, I observed a bird that was about the size of a sparrow with a bright red head that kind of went to orange at the neck, completely black body, black wings. The black wings had a white horizontal stripe across the wing.
Hmm.
Never seen anything like that ever, and I asked a couple of my birder friends. They said, well, maybe it was an escaped exotic.
That's almost what it sounds like. Overall black body, white on the wings, and red head. Hmm. Yeah, there's nothing as a native bird, at least certainly not normal plumage, that has anywhere near the color. In fact, red is not that common among our Wisconsin birds. There's only a few that would exhibit that. But, you know, there's so many different things that could be in the pet trade. So you never know what gets out from somebody that's an escaped exotic. I've seen a few out in the wild. I remember several years ago, that was quite a long time ago, somebody had a Brazilian cardinal that was coming to a feeder. You know, there's always that chance. And I would assume for that unusual plumage, it is something exotic. Unfortunately, there's no picture that you have available. Otherwise, if I could look at the general shape, the bill, and some of that, I might be able to give you a bit of a hint of what it might be, since I've seen a pretty good variety of birds around the world. But, yeah, it's certainly not a Wisconsin bird of anything I can think of.
Yeah. Thank you, Susie. Appreciate it. Diane in Burlington. Yeah. Diane, your turn. Hi.
Hi, Larry and Bill. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have some cedar trim on my house. In springtime, I had a little woodpecker that pecked through a hole, and I scared it away, and we filled the hole. Last night, I had a blue jay in the same spot pecking the same hole, scaring him away. And I'm just wondering, do they know something more than I do? Do they just generally peck away at the wood, or are there some insects or pests in there that I'm not seeing?
Yeah, it could be that there's actual some insects that got in there that they're actually trying to extract from it. Our house, we've got a wood siding to it. It's not cedar. And I had downy woodpeckers that were really riddling that. And I'm sure I did not have that much of an insect infestation into my siding for all the holes I had. My assumption was that the woodpeckers were just tapping, like probing or prospecting a little bit. And my assumption is they're probably tapping the wood looking for softer hollow spots, because if you're tapping along a tree and looking for a soft spot, usually it means that there's an insect that has burrowed into it, and it usually rewards you with food. So at least my assumption is that they were tapping around, looking into something, oh, nope, nothing here, try another spot. And they're pretty well riddled by my siding over the years. We patched that up and stained it all, and one side. Well, we actually changed the siding, and it was more because the sun had leached out than woodpecker damage. But yeah, that's what happens when your house looks like a huge tree. But there is always a chance that there is some insects that got into there as well, especially the fact that you said that there was a blue jay there. Woodpecker, as I say, they may or may not actually be looking for food or just looking for likely spots where food may be. But for a blue jay to come back and be working it, I'd almost think that he's looking for something specifically.
Hmm. Diane, thank you. Appreciate your call. Jane in Duluth, Minnesota, will go to you now. Hi, Jane.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
I have the birds plant sunflower seeds around my feeders, and I let them grow and get big. And this year is the first time I've noticed that instead of taking when the seeds ripen, they just go crazy for it. I looked at it and I said, they're not eating it. And I looked close, and every single ripe seed in there was pecked out. And apparently somebody's learning to peck out the seeds and pull the kernels out. And I'm really surprised that I've never seen that before. Is that usual?
I wouldn't think that's very unusual. My most likely suspects, I would think, would be little chickadees. They're certainly able to extract that kind of food and take it out. Downy woodpecker is another one that may be pulling a seed or two, but chickadees tend to be in loose flocks, especially this time of the year. And, you know, for that many seeds to be gone, it sounds like it's more than one bird taking a seed out of there. Maybe you're lucky enough at some point to actually see a bird coming into the flower that you can identify which one you've got there. But, food's certainly abundant this time of year. It's the height of the season. It is that harvest season for things in nature as well as for humans. So they're taking advantage of whatever's ripe out there.
Thank you, Jane. Appreciate it. Laura in Menominee Falls emailed. She has a ruby-throated hummingbird who visits her yard, especially her Rosa Sharon bush. She's seen the bird for some years and wonders how long do they live. Will their offspring visit the same food areas, and where do they migrate to and when?
Oh, good question. Hummingbirds, I think like a lot of our other smaller birds, average lifespan is probably about 3 to 5 years. They're difficult to actually band, mark an individual, and then recapture because they are just so small and have such extremely small legs. So the chance that somebody's going to actually capture the same bird again years later is probably a pretty small chance. We have had records of some of these being captured again 10 years later. But that's always the problem. Unless you have a marked individual, just because you see a bird year after year in your own backyard doesn't mean it's the same individual, because after all the adult males for hummingbirds look exactly the same. And if you live in one house long enough, there's got to be a turnover rate. But I would say 3 to 5 years at least. And I would imagine that some of those young are coming back to those same sites where they were raised and they were successful. This is a long-distance migrant for a little guy like that. They're going to Central America, some of them even to the far northern part of South America. So they've got a good flight of about 2 to 2,500 miles from here, heading down to escape our wintertime. And some of these will make flights from the Texas coast across the Gulf of Mexico to Yucatan or even into Central America. So over water flights of 500 to 600 miles nonstop. There have been reports of when these birds are coming across the Gulf, they run into head-on winds that are unfavorable for them, and they'll be landing out on the oil derricks or sometimes on ships. And on occasion, in some pretty big numbers. I talked to somebody who worked a ship down there, said that one year they had what must have been 150 hummingbirds that were just in the morning hanging all over their ship and picked up and left again looking for a rest spot where normally there isn't any out there. So, yeah, it's for that little guy, I mean, that's an amazing flight. Average flight speed for hummingbirds estimated about 30 miles an hour, which is not unusual for small birds. And, of course, in migration, they're looking for a good north wind. Most of them migrate at night. So if we've got a nice cool front that comes through with a tailwind, they'll pick up and head out on that. So that's what they're doing now. And they sort of leapfrog in migration. They'll find a good weather system, head out, take it for all it's worth until their fuel tank runs empty, stop, rest, refuel, and then pick up on the journey. And some of these birds may be able to make it from here all the way down there in less than a month's time.
Good question, Jane. Thank you again. Michael in Spring Green emailed to ask if there's a good, if there is good data on bird deaths due to wind turbines, and who is collecting that kind of data?
Well, when the wind farms were going up in Wisconsin, that was all part of the project, that there were studies done beforehand for siting where they were going to see what birds were occurring in the area. And then they were under contract for at least 3 years afterwards, where people were surveying underneath to look for birds. The problem is that if a bird strikes something like these large wind turbines, they don't look like they're moving that fast, but some of these have a huge blade sweep. And on the outer part of that blade, they may be going over 150 miles an hour. So if that were to strike a bird, it doesn't just say necessarily knock the bird down and have it lay on the ground. The bird may actually somewhat explode up there. The other question, and this was another study done where they actually were picking up roadkill birds, freezing them, and then laying them out in a field just to see if a bird did die, whether it was from a pesticide exposure or for anything else, how long would that carcass remain there that it even be detectable by a researcher? And what they found was that somewhere around almost 75% of those were picked up in the first evening. And within 3 days, they were all gone. So you would have to have a bird strike and somebody be out there the very next morning and hope that even then a raccoon or a possum didn't pick it up right away that evening if it was out working that field. So the data is a little bit skewed. We think for the most part, they're probably not a major factor for most songbirds, since their migration is taking them a little higher than the sweep of those, though that's not to say that they are not a hazard. And as I've said for years, any human structure, you put it up high enough in the air, it's a potential obstacle for birds migrating because they're flying at night. So our tall buildings, our communication towers, all of these are at least potential problems for birds. And the real problem for birds is that it compounds all the things that are working against them. So it's not a single mortality factor that's affecting birds. We know that populations are declining, and since the 1970s, it's been estimated that 3 billion birds have been lost in North America. Numbers are down by about 25% over the last 50 years. What's affecting them? Well, habitat loss here with land conversion and development. Habitat conversion on the wintering grounds, whether it's tall structures, whether it's outdoor cats, whether it's our windows and glass that birds fly into, the answer is always what's killing birds, D, all the above. And it's those cumulative effects that are really starting to work against them. It's a human-dominated world, and it's no longer as bird-friendly as it used to be. But there are things we can do to ameliorate that, and certainly around our own homes. Keep your cat indoors. Enjoy the birds by feeding them and keeping those feeding stations clean. Do some good planting around your yard of native plants that are going to provide shelter, natural food, and nesting spaces for birds. And put something on your windows to reduce those window strikes. Maybe you only hear 3 or 4 or 5 birds a year that hit your windows. But think of every house in your neighborhood and all the houses across Wisconsin. That adds up to literally millions of birds that we could help to reduce that by putting up something as make the windows more visible, and there's a number of good sources for that. So there's a lot of things we can do for birds, and we're certainly, all the callers we're sharing with their information today are enjoying birds, and so many people do, but we also got to ensure that they're going to be here. And remember, Wisconsin is the nesting ground. They're leaving now just to escape the winter. So certainly the people down in the tropics have to provide the winter home to keep them alive, but this is where they raise their young. That's a one crack of the year to be able to build their numbers up, and we've got to provide that important habitat and safety for them.
Thank you very much for that comment, and great answer there, Bill. Cal in Sugar Camp, you have a question.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, the introduced swans that are here, are those the mute swans?
Yes, there are 3 major species of swans found in North America. The 2 native ones are the trumpeter swan, which has been reintroduced as a nesting bird in Wisconsin, the migrant tundra swan, the old name called whistling swan. These are birds that will migrate through in big numbers
usually in March, early April. We'll see them come across Wisconsin on their way up to the Arctic nesting grounds, and they'll be coming back again around Thanksgiving and early December. We'll see the big flocks come through on their way to the Chesapeake Bay and the East Coast. Mute swan is a European species that was brought over usually for some of the big estates out east is where they originally were introduced, and then they started breeding in the wild, becoming well-established and making home around here. There has been a concern that they do compete with the trumpeter swan or attempts to try to reintroduce that species, and it's a bird that just doesn't belong here. So, again, we want to reduce competition and protect our native birds. And so this is always a problem of these exotics that are getting out there. And in a sense, just like your buckthorn or honeysuckle or like carp, yeah, these are invasive species if they start to compete with our natives, things that were not intended to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Kel. Appreciate it. Sandy emailed to ask if you can suggest a couple of good birding viewing areas in the state at the end of September and into October.
Yes. In fact, I was hoping to pass that on for people. Good viewing places are found all over Wisconsin. Any of the marshes and our wildlife areas and refuges are certainly areas of ideal habitat. So make a trip to a state park, to a wildlife area, any of even the city parks, Milwaukee County. There's been some great reports from bird watchers finding birds there and in the Madison area. The Great Lakes shores, these are certainly good migratory corridors. If people would like to gather with people, of course, there's a certain bit of a concern of how large crowds get, but the State Ornithological Society has a fall bird walk at Marinette. That's scheduled, that was September 9th, I'm sorry, Green Bay Warblers this Saturday, September 11th. The Jaegerfest, which takes place up on Wisconsin Point up by Superior, that's the weekend of September 17th through the 19th. Jaegers are distant relatives of the gulls. They'll be coming in from the Arctic, and oftentimes we'll spend some time over the Great Lakes. There's a hawk watch going on in Harrington Beach in October. So a number of nature centers are starting to gear up again with some of the public programs. The Mississippi River is definitely a great corridor for migrant birds, both songbirds and water birds. I don't know if there's a great places to go. There's a lot of them, but it's a great time of year to get out there. And it's a wonderful activity for people to get outside and enjoy nature. And birds, to me, have always been just that fascinating window to the natural world. You watch birds, and all of a sudden they get you out into so much else of nature. And it gives a way for us to keep a pulse and a bit of a finger on things. By the way, I also want to pass on for people who are using their cell phones a wonderful app that you may want to use for identifying birds. It's called the Merlin app, named after, well, it could be named after the falcon, the Merlin, or Merlin the magician. Cornell University developed this, and you can download it at merlin.allaboutbirds, or just search Merlin app. And it's a free download. In your pocket, in the palm of your hand, identification of all the birds of North America, or just download the packs. They call it bird packs for the upper Midwest. Gives you a picture of the bird, gives you a map of the distribution of the birds during its nesting period, winter period, migration.
We have
song recordings on it. And they
lots
just
there.
Added a whole new feature, which is song identification.
Oh, man.
Identify the birds for you.
You know what? We're out of time, Bill. Thank you so much for being with us today, Bill Volkert. But take a look at that app from Cornell. It's a dandy. And thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.